There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Today we sit down for our first one-on-one chat with a working artist. Carl Handel is a rising star in the art world. His large-scale photorealist pencil drawings have garnered lots of attention around the globe, and Philbrook just acquired a piece depicting NFL superstar and former University of Oklahoma standout Adrian Peterson. It's on view in the current Philbrook Downtown show, Game On. Where did that kind of start for you in terms of that's what I'm good at, that's where my talent lies, knowing that this was the direction you were going to go in?
Well, I was always pretty good at drawing. I was one of those kids that could just sort of sit alone for hours with like pencil or crayons and draw. And my parents, like in the basement, they had like, it wasn't quite a finished basement, but they put carpet down and like, there was like toys and art supplies down there, and I'd build models and I would.
And where is this? Where are you growing up? Where is this house?
I grew up in Long Island, sort of just into Nassau County. So it was like a nice Jewish neighborhood, but a suburb of New York City.
So you have this.
About a half an hour.
So you have this nice basement, like the kids and Stranger Things, they hang out in the basement down there, and you're drawing all the time there?
Yeah, I would draw a lot. Paint and sculpt, and in school, in high school, I was very into photography. It was into all types of art. It wasn't, drawing was just one. It wasn't really in any way a specialty. I was sort of more into photography in undergrad, and then I would say just as much, it wasn't that I was particularly drawn to drawing. Maybe more I was drawn to the ideas of art, and I think that I was, even as a kid, probably somewhat of an appropriation artist and also like somewhat of a political artist, even as a little kid. I remember when I think I was in like second grade, we had this thing where we had to like make Christmas ornaments, which is weird because everyone in my school was a Jew. I mean, I'm from Long Island, but we had like this thing where we had these eggs. Maybe it was Easter. Why?
Making Easter eggs in
Jews
school.
Yeah, making Easter eggs. So we had this thing where we had to make Easter eggs, or they were eggs that we were turning into Christmas ornaments. I don't remember, but I had this egg, and everyone in the class was supposed to decorate an egg. I think it was in second grade, and I made it into a Tylenol capsule. Because even
was it one of those plastic eggs?
It was those ones. No, it was a real egg.
Oh, like an actual egg.
We drained out, and we were supposed to decorate it.
Okay.
And I made mine into a Tylenol capsule because right around that time there was this thing where some people got sick
with
Tylenol capsules.
Yeah.
If you remember, we were about the same age.
Yeah.
Maybe this was early 80s and there was this scare and, you know.
That's where the childproof cap came from.
I guess
that right?
So.
I think there was some connection to that.
So like everyone brought in like flowers on their eggs and mine was a Tylenol capsule, like straight out of the headlines.
So you're making pharmaceuticals out of eggs.
So
you're making a statement. You saw something in the news and you heard about something.
Yeah, I was like in fourth grade. There was stuff about nuclear bombs and Holocaust. You know, Reagan was all into the Star Wars thing. And I was making like left-leaning, you know, like tempera paintings in art class.
I remember being a kid in, you know, mid to late 80s and thinking about the Russian threat. And thinking about, you know, there were so many films at that time that were pitting, you know, the Russians against the United States. And it was kind of in the popular culture very heavily at that time. So it's not surprising that a kid, you know, would see something, whether it's that or some kind of frightening thing in the news, like about Tylenol or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And I was interested in the Libyan war in 1989, I think. And seeing that war on TV in a way that was different than, because there were all these cameras.
Did you remember Gaddafi as this kind of character that you would see?
I do remember Gaddafi as a character, but I remember the Ayatollah as a character, but I remember a lot of politicians. Like I remember, you know, Jesse Jackson. He was great. But the visualization of the Libyan war was the first time we would see these sort of like, they were laser-guided bombs. And that was different than the kind of war footage we saw before, like on PBS. And it was this digital type of that the kind of thing you see now, like with Iraq war, was like a drone. It was the beginning of that. So I remember seeing that on TV and being really drawn to that, like those images.
So I wonder, it seems like the concept of observation, when I'm looking at your work, is obviously a huge component of that, because I would imagine spending the time that you do on these pieces, which I, you know, you can, we can talk about that in a moment, which I would imagine these are fairly time consuming projects. You're observing something, whether it's a photograph or whatever the source material is, you're looking at it. And I would assume when you're spending that much time with it, you're looking beyond just the aesthetic. You're thinking about the context and what's going on in that. So have you always been a hyper observational guy?
I think I was always interested in the real world. In reality, in some vague idea of realism. I was very interested in photojournalism and still am. Not that photojournalism presents the truth, but there, and in journalism in general, like journalism doesn't say we are presenting the truth. They're saying we are trying to get closer to this truth. It's elusive.
It's a pursuit of some kind.
Yeah, it's a pursuit of what happened, of facts. And I'm interested in facts and what is. So I studied, as I was saying, like photography. I was quite into photography in high school and in college. And then kind of my background in college was more conceptual art and theory and semiotics. I was a semiotics major. But the drawing part, so I was interested in photography, but I always found that making a photograph was somehow, the thing itself in front of me was lacking a kind of oomph, a kind of presence. And I started making drawings because I wanted the object in the space to have a little bit more life, more personality, more labor, more time, more love, and like a photocopy. I was doing a lot of text drawings. I didn't start making realist drawings. I was drawing mostly newspapers. I wanted to say, like, okay, if I found this newspaper article, like in the back of the Guardian newspaper, like a small little article, I wanted to say, this is really important. But here it is on like page 30 of the newspaper. Like no one's going to read it. This is important. How do I can blow it up. I can draw it and spend a month drawing this article. And then it will have a kind of presence that people will give it more time. So that's
were you changing the scale? You were making these large scale where it was maybe a 2-inch story in the back of the paper. So you literally were giving it more space in the world.
And it's saying demand to look at me because I'm important. And the Guardian used to run these things. They still might. I haven't seen a copy in a while, called In Brief. And it was one paragraph, little snippets of, like, stories that happened in the world. And they're horrible. It's like a woman and daughter eaten by same snake. The British have a better way about it. They write their headlines with such a sort of, like, cool irony. So they'd be, like, 8 of these.
That tabloid influence that kind of runs through some of those things.
So, and then I would blow that up to, like, 12 feet.
Yeah.
And that's how I started getting into drawing, you know, realistically, that there would be images in some of these newspaper articles. And I drew, and I remember one I drew, the first sort of super realist one I drew was of a dog wearing a gas mask. And that was about an article also in The Guardian about the British training, like a secret program during World War II to get their dogs to wear gas masks so they wouldn't be gassed. And they did this test and they found out that, yes, the dogs can survive a gas attack, but unfortunately they are no use as dogs because they can't smell. So,
and there was a photograph in there that you used as the basis for this image?
Yeah,
this
I just copied it.
So when was that? When was that first piece that you would kind of say that was the beginning of that journey?
I think that was in 2000.
Okay, so we're getting close to, say, 20 years of going down this path. When you started doing that and you're finding these things that intrigue you and make you want to spend time with them, it seems like most of the work now a lot of times features people, you know, versus inanimate objects, but there's both. But I wonder, I'm sure it changes, but for an average work, for example, the work that we have that we acquired here at the museum, which is Adrian Peterson, the football player, and a piece called Wishbone, mid-rush when he was playing for the Minnesota Vikings. And you see this image, you want to do this. It's going to take you, how long did that piece specifically take you to complete from concept to creation?
Those football player drawings take about 3 months, 2 to 3 months.
So you're going to dedicate a quarter of the year to a project like this.
That's one person. So I have a couple assistants.
Right.
Lest you think that I do all the labor.
But still, you're choosing to give a chunk of your life to this.
It takes a long time.
Why
and a lot of money because I pay this. It's
exactly. But when you decide to do something, are there sometimes where you have a false start where you decide halfway through that this project isn't going to take the way you thought? Or does perfectionism take over and you say, I'm going to fix this and get it to the way I want it? You know, what's that journey like in terms of getting it exactly the way you want it to be? And how do you know when it's just right?
I think I work more like a photographer who sees the composition. They see the composition and then they press the shutter. And then what happens. And they do a lot before they press the shutter. But once the shutter happens, that's what happens. Like, I was also the kind of photographer who liked to print full frame. I didn't like to do crop. I liked to crop before. And then I wanted to end that decision making. So all of my photos were full frame. If there was a 6x6, they were square. If they were whatever, if it was 35 millimeter, they were the elongated rectangle. So for me, the decision to say, I'm going to do this drawing, that's the clicking of the shutter. And I make all the decisions beforehand and I do it in the computer. I do it by a lot of research. So like, I have a big archive of tons and tons of football players. Let's say that I wanted to make those football player drawings. I might have had 30 images I could choose from, or 40, and collected them in newspapers, online.
Like, oh, this one's interesting. Maybe I'll hold that.
Yeah, and then I lay them out on the – and then I take a slide of all of them and I lay them out on the slide table and I look at them together. And then once I decide the ones I'm going to do – then it just becomes about time and labor and effort, and I know how to draw. So once I don't do any of that kind of old school shit that like you'd see like artists in movies do, where like they paint a brush stroke and then they sit back in a chair and they have a smoke and they look at it and they go, a little more purple, and then they go do that. I don't do that. It's more clinical and analytical, and I do that beforehand at a desk. And what I do is I'll be like, okay, what does this mean to have a giant football player drawing? What is this in relationship to history painting, to violence in America? What is the relationship to capital, to race? All of these guys are black. They're all men. What is this about masculinity? And I think through what all the implications are. And then I have all those ideas going in my head, and that helps me find the right image.
And then at the end of the day, when the work is complete, it's the ultimate test, though, to say, this work is almost exactly like this smaller piece.
No.
You know, how do you, because I would say the average viewer walks into a gallery and they see a big work like this. And the thing that I think immediately strikes them is the fact of course, how realistic it looks, right? That's like maybe the gut first thing that they get. And then the layers start going on.
It depends on the type of viewer.
And the scope of the thing, maybe.
Yeah, like, well, actually, it's even art viewers, even like people who are habitual and sort of insiders still are, be like, whoa, that's cool. And that's okay because I'm not...
Whoa, that's cool is a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing. I think I'm a populist. And when I say that, I mean I want my art to appeal to people of different backgrounds. So just like a person who doesn't have an art background, who's walking by a museum, maybe only goes once a year, and if they see something cool, that brings them into the museum. And that's important. And hopefully that there's more content there that they can access. But there really is a conceptual logic behind all of what I do. And I'm foremost probably a conceptual artist. And the realism or the photorealism that I sometimes employ is just to kind of have some sexy things to get people in the door. Like, I don't want to only make big football player drawings. It takes too long. And I don't want to be known as that. And it's not that interesting. I made a bunch of them. But I really only needed to make two or three. You know, it doesn't look exactly like the photo because sometimes I will get rid of things. Like, those photos had backgrounds. And it's all black in the one in the museum. But there was, like, fans and, like, other players in the background, like a referee.
So there's a reduction happening.
Yeah, so I get rid of that, and I might change a foot or a hand or get rid of something or a player if it doesn't look right. So I'm trying to make, like, a good overall composition. And then I'm thinking about, okay, these entangled men, like overly muscled men, this is Rococo. So I look back at some Rococo, you know, ceilings from like the 1600s and see how Michelangelo entwined some bodies in the Last Judgment. And then I want to see those compositions and see how these stack up to that.
I guess my question to that is, does it matter to you? Because, you know, there's always this ongoing argument of, you know, I do my art for me. And you just said you're a populist and you want people to respond a certain way to your work, which means you do have some sense of an audience and you want to have some reaction from the audience. So it's not just like, I do it for me. I don't care what anybody else thinks.
I don't do it for me at all.
But I wonder if someone doesn't get that, okay, if they don't see that.
See what?
Those underlying threads, right? Let's say they don't read the label. and they don't get that you saw this reference point that you wanted to put in there. Does that make the work any less successful if they respond to it on an emotional level? Because if you look at the amount of time a lot of people spend looking at a work of art, for example, our piece, you have this whole giant wall to yourself. This piece is on the wall. You have this breathing room for people to come in and really take it in. Whereas if there were 10 of your pieces right there, all lined up perfectly, you know, at a certain height off of the wall, maybe the impact would not be the same because they wouldn't have time to really invest in that one frame, you know. I guess I'm just wondering what your expectations of the viewer are, because it seems like people take away something different every time they see it. So how much of the work that goes on behind the scenes is for you intellectually versus what you want to give to the audience?
Yeah, I'm not one of, if I didn't have an audience, if I didn't have places to show my work, if I couldn't participate in a kind of dialogue, mostly with the dialogue I think I'm participating with is with other artists ultimately, like I'm talking to them and with them. But we need the public there to enable that conversation. If I couldn't do that, I don't think I would make art because there'd be no point. I might still do creative things in my own time, but I don't know if I would do these same things. So you have to have opportunity to show and have an audience. No, it's fine. People can access it anyway. This is why I'm saying that I'm a populist, because a lot of the art that artists I studied with and the background I have is like in a pretty elitist academic type of art making, which I understand, like highly conceptual, research-based, institutional critique, social practice. These are the kind of art kind of stuff that I studied. I went to the Whitney program, which is something in New York that the Whitney
Museum studied under Baldessari at UCLA, right?
Baldessari was one of my teachers. Mary Kelly was my advisor. So Mary Kelly is like, I don't even understand. She talks about Lacan all the time. And she's, you know, we're very friendly. And now I show at the same galleries as her, which is weird. But her work is not accessible in the way mine is accessible. And that's fine with her because she's not, there are plenty of artists who make very obscure work and they're just not interested in a bigger audience. I am. I think about the first time that I went to MoMA when I was 13. And that, I mean, I'm pretty privileged. At 13, I could go to MoMA because I just lived outside the city. But I was able to access some of the work there. And
do you remember what you saw there, you know, on that first trip?
Of it, I don't think I even don't agree with my premise there, because I remember seeing an Adrian Piper video when I was 13 years old. And Adrian Piper is not an accessible work. I mean, it was like a white room with this TV in the center. It was an installation, an Adrian Piper installation. And she was interrogating the audience about their privilege and their race.
And where was this?
It was in MoMA.
This was at MoMA.
In, I think, one of the projects series, or maybe they were doing their installation show then.
This is like late 80s, maybe?
Yeah, late 80s. Yeah, 89, 90, something like that. If I could access Adrian Piper at 13, then maybe it's fine. I don't know. But some people are not.
Is that the first museum visit that you really look back on as kind of the...
That was really formidable, because I remember seeing the Brock Picasso show, which was like a really important show. And I was trying to figure out if I could tell the differences between the Brocks and the Picassos by the end of the show. And again, I'm like 13 or 14. So that is something about connoisseurship. But there was also at the same time installation work by contemporary artists like Adrian Piper. And I think there was a Act Up, which I think is did an installation about AIDS. I remember seeing that. And
are you going with a school group or are your parents taking you? You know, how did you get to MoMA? Who initiated this visit, do you think?
My parents took me that time. Like, they were like, we're going to go see some museum stuff in the city.
So were they museum people? Did you guys go to museums a lot?
No, sometimes we went to the Nassau County Museum, which was like closer to our house, which was in some ways a little similar to the Philbrook, like a nice sculpture garden with a few pieces of art, but like not a major museum. I went to a lot. I took art classes there. And by the time I was in high school, I was going into the city and I could see art myself.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by text panels, those little squares or rectangles stuck on the wall next to works of art. From short and simple to verbose and abstruse, there's a wide variety of text panels in museums all around the world. The next time you see something and want to know more, look around for a text panel, the quickest way we know of, caption-wise, to get from WTF to OMFG.
W- Were you a known quantity as an artist in high school? Did people know you were an artist and that you might want to be going this route? Was it like, here's Carl, he's going to be an artist, you know, he's going to do
Probably. I definitely wasn't on the football team.
Did you go to a public school?
I did, yes.
Yeah.
But it was a very big public school. It was a good public school.
Good art program?
Yeah, pretty good.
You know, compared to now, which is, you know, they seem to be losing them all the time. But you know.
I went to a good school, a very good public school, because of the way we fund education in this country. Like, if you live in an expensive area, you have a high tax base. So the houses were a lot in the North Shore of Long Island. So there's good schools in that area.
You talked about, obviously, you're very interested in photography, and that's the basis for a lot of this work. And I wonder, there's so many conversations happening now about appropriation and transforming a work. And I wonder, in those early days, say around 2000, when you really start pursuing these photorealist things and you're finding imagery in newspapers and different places, are you having to ask permission from the photographers? How does that work? Even for an art piece, you know, which was taken from, you know, a still from a football game, which is, I guess, technically owned by the NFL, that broadcast. There's all these different things. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've had to deal with some of these issues of, I'm changing it, you're removing elements. We already talked about that. Is that purely transformational? Do you ever have to get into these kind of non-creative thoughts about how, who owns the image that you're doing?
I've only had a couple run-ins with sort of like copyright issue stuff. And I'm of the generation that young artists now are appropriating at such a pace and a degree that you can't even separate it. It's everything is appropriation. I mean, the idea that one would be, that anything would, I mean, even younger than me, I mean, like, originality is just a weird concept. If you think about the idea of the retweet or the re-Instagram, it's like everything comes from somewhere and you are just a little link in the chain. So when I visit young artist studios, the, like, do you get permission from this? Where did you source this? Everything is just like a mess. It's like a giant soup with all the stuff thrown in. Well, and you can't really,
we're in this weird middle place where the concept of fair use and things like that are just so up in the air. Do you think that's a natural progression from Warhol, Rauschenberg, all these people who have used things in their work? Is that just a natural progression? I'm speaking specifically about the art world right now. A natural progression. I mean, this is not brand new. Of course, you know, for the last 50, 60 years, even beyond that, people have been using popular culture imagery in work and doing things like that. That, I don't think anything's changed in that regard. But when you see cases like, of course, Shepard Fairey and some of those more famous elements like that happening, you've done Bob Dylan, you've done Hillary Clinton, you've done all the, you know, Alfred Hitchcock, all these different people. Have you ever heard from representatives of foundations or saying you're using the art, someone's image inappropriately or anything like that?
I only had one issue where a commercial photographer, there's a few things in that question, so we get, but I only had one issue. Commercial photographers are pretty touchy about this stuff. And I found an image on someone's website that was not his website. So I didn't know it came. I would never touch commercial photographers because I know they're really, like, this is how they make their living.
Do not enter. Yeah.
Yeah. But someone had already stolen his image and put it on their own thing. Their
Which speaks to
something.
This bigger conversation already.
But then I drew this picture of this guy. And I took it because it was this picture of this generic guy that I drew full scale. And I put it up in a museum, in a show in the Indianapolis Museum of Art. And the guy that I drew went to the show.
Randomly.
I don't know him. I mean, imagine that.
The subject, not the photographer.
The subject of my drawing, which was also the subject of this commercial photographer's commercial image.
And imagine the moment you walk into a gallery.
I just want to know what
not
was
expecting
going
to see yourself, and I you mean, see yourself. How big was this piece? Very large,
life
right?
Life size. So he was like looking at a mirror, except it was a pencil drawing of himself. I've never met him.
Wow.
And then
that's like a piece of performance art that happened accidentally.
Imagine what's going through his head. Like, that's me. What am I doing here? What's going on? It's like a Twilight Zone episode.
Whatever happened, this seems like it was worth it just from that moment.
It's a good story. And so he, I guess, was like, oh, I remember when this is from a picture. I remember when it was taken. My friend in San Francisco, who's a photographer, took my picture. He called that guy called his agent. The agent sent a threatening letter to my art dealer and to the museum and blah, blah, blah. And threatening letters ensued. One, he's citing all these cases of copyright law, like from the 80s, and then my dealer is citing copyright law more recently that Richard Prince has won. They go back and forth, and then no one wanted to sue anyone. He just wanted money from me. Like, they had no desire to have a lawsuit because they think there's a good case that all of my drawings are transformative because a photograph, context matters.
Yes.
And material matters. So it's on the line, but usually there's some sort of editing in terms of composition and stuff, but scale and the medium, and like, they're much bigger than where they started. They're in a different medium and they're in a different context. So when there's a really good drawing and some commercial photographer or some photographer comes after me and I like the drawing, I will take it to court because I think I could win on transformation. I mean, the basic argument that Duchamp made when he took the urinal, which was the same urinal they sell in the, you know, urinal supply place, and he puts it in the art context, he says, this is different. What's different is the context. And if that makes art, then by changing the context from taking this out of like the sports section or the Sports Illustrated and blowing it up, changing the medium, putting it in the museum, the context is drastically shifted.
For a work like the one that you did for Adrian Peterson, the piece that we acquired for the museum here, you said these pieces take maybe 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
How many pencils are you using to make something like this? You know, I mean, it's all pencil, mm-hmm. right? What kind of pencil is it and how many pencils are you using? And are you specific about you only use a certain kind
yes,
of pencil?
I only use a certain type of pencil. I use Faber-Castell 9000 pencils. There's really just Staedtler and Faber-Castell, which are both made in Germany. And if you use pencils, you have to use a good quality pencil.
This is not a number two yellow pencil that we get in school. No.
No, it's not, because those are different qualities. You know, so what you need is if I pick up a 2B, I need to know that no matter what 2B I pick up, it's going to be exactly the same as the last one I picked up. So if you switch manufacturers, a different grade can be a little lighter, a little darker. And the leads need to be really consistent, like throughout the pencil itself. So sometimes you would have like a cheap school pencil might break and you don't want that. So you need consistency across the whole board. And Faber-Castell, I think, makes the best pencil. So I've been using those for like 20 years probably.
So on a big scale piece, how many are you going through for one work?
Well, the black in that piece we use a lot because that was a 3B with a 4B and 5B on top. So I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 pencils.
Oh, wow. That seems not very many. That's pretty amazing.
That was a lot.
I was thinking like
pencil extenders.
So I was thinking like 1,000 or something that.
But I do buy pencils at about, how many do I buy at a time? I buy them around 500 at a time.
Yeah. You're good for the pencil business right now. You're one of their favorite customers right now.
I think they should sponsor me.
Hey,
but they're probably
like a NASCAR thing where you have like,
yeah.
You know, like.
I mean, I just said their name, Faber-Castell.
Yeah. Would you wear a patch while you were working that says, you know, something like that, like a jumpsuit that
it
says.
Save me a lot of money. I would wear it.
So you've chosen this neutral palette that obviously pencil, black and white kind mm-hmm. of format that is reflective of photojournalism, newspaper photography. And you've chosen not to go in that more colorful route that is really trying to mimic, you know, the colors of the world at large. You know, when you see it, yes, it does feel like photorealistic, but it's more like a photo rather than real life. You know, you're not seeing the flesh of the human tone and all these things. And I wonder if that's always been something that you've done on purpose to avoid what they call in the, you know, animation world is the uncanny valley, right? This is the uncanny valley is where in animation you get so close to where it seems uncomfortable because it seems too realistic, almost like a trompe l'oeil kind of scenario. Why go this route rather than doing something more based in the colors and look of, because obviously newspapers are mostly color photography now,
mm-hmm.
But you stick to this palette. I just wonder what the reasoning behind that was.
I think it's mostly aesthetics, that I personally don't care for things that are overly decorative, and my taste runs more towards minimalism and conceptual art, and I think it's important that I establish that that's where my affinities are, that I want to see myself in line more with, you know, let's say Mel Bachner or Donald Judd somehow more than like Cindy Sherman.
Yeah, that's interesting you said that. We're doing a big show of Bachner next year. So.
I know, that's why he was on my mind.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, he's one of my favorite artists. And I think that I make a lot of drawings that are not realist drawings, a lot of abstract drawings, a lot of text drawings, a lot of sort of notational kind of funky drawings, a lot of drawings with language. I mean, asterisks, question marks, parentheses. It's like I make drawings just of parentheses. So this idea of me being like hyper real, or it doesn't, if you were to see one of my complete shows, it wouldn't even come up there, this issue of being too close to reality. It just becomes one more type of representation. But of course, they're kind of like the sexy ones. You know, people like that. People don't want to see a drawing of a newspaper. They want to see something like, oh my God, look at those football players. They're so amazing. And that's important because you have to pair that. I want to pair those amazing moments with things that are slightly disturbing or slightly uncomfortable.
Well, it's like you're making a playlist. You know, it's like you're making a mixtape, an experience where there's ups and downs, emotional changes, all these different things throughout a gallery.
So in the installation, you want that. You want these different types of thoughts activated. And you want to pair, or I want to often pair the kind of sexiness that you get. I mean, like an image can be alluring through its realism. That's what I mean.
Yeah, because if you looked at one wall and it made you cry, and then you turned around and this one makes you laugh, that's a pretty stellar moment. You know, if that could happen in a gallery, or this one makes you go, "That's amazing," and this one you go, "Whoa, that's a little disturbing."
Yeah, and then makes you question both of those.
Yeah,
and to pair that kind of allure with this violence of American football and this, the brutality and what we enjoy as a culture watching and paying for.
But I wonder something like, I was thinking about M.C. Escher, for example, right? Uh-huh. And I was thinking about the fact that as a kid, M.C. Escher was like on every friend of mine's wall, you know, and it would be like the one with the two hands drawing each other or the, you know, the stairs, the crazy stairs, all these things. And the thing that I always thought with that is, one, those were very realistic, like those hands are amazing, but the subject matter was very surrealistic, right? And he is someone that, you know, never gets talked about much in terms of respect in the art world. And he's kind of almost like relegated to like a Thomas Kincaid level, you know, of populist art. But I wonder, there hasn't been in the last 50 years, I would say, people who do sketch, you know, pencil sketch drawing, someone who's broken out into the mainstream like that. And I think that was kind of one thing that was kind of totally interesting about that work, which was, it was kind of in this one medium. Of course, the subject matter may have been the thing that really broke it out, that kind of strange, weird subject matter.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when you're doing someone like Bob Dylan or you're doing someone like Hillary Clinton, which was within the last couple of years, do you see a response that you know is based just on the subject matter when you're seeing people say, oh, you know, I love Bob Dylan, so I'm going to have an affinity for this work in a different kind of way?
Yeah, that's one of the weaknesses of that work. I don't mind doing it with Hillary Clinton. I think that was an important history painting to make, because I think about history painting, and not just paintings, like videos and installations that I would also consider in the realm of history painting, in the way that the French Academy considered history painting the highest level, and they would be genre painting and maybe still life painting, but history painting was the equivalent of writing the great novel, but visually. And I think about that. So when I did that Hillary Clinton drawing, it was during the election. I didn't know if she was going to win or lose, and it was the biggest drawing I ever made, and I thought it was very important.
In terms of size, how big was it?
160 long by maybe 110 tall, 120 tall. It was
160 inches by 110 or so. Yeah,
110 up. And there was a big Hillary Clinton on one side and then a big empty space on the other. And it was important for me to make a drawing at this scale and give this much time to what I hoped would be the first female president. And this big blanked out empty space that I thought of as the unknown, as a man. It could be Trump. It could be Bill Clinton. It could be Barack. It could be any man next to her that I'm not going to draw.
And the empty space, if I remember correctly, is on the left side.
Yes.
Yes.
And it's just blacked out with just a lot of labor and time. Yeah. And that didn't to me feel like there was any problem. That was thinking about the history of the world. And I knew it could be a really happy picture and a really sad one about this idea, like, could we have a woman be the most powerful person of the world, or would we choose anyone but that? The Bob Dylan's, because I love Bob Dylan, but I do know that there's a couple people who buy those because they just love Bob Dylan. And that's a problem. You don't just want to please, like, some Bob Dylan collector.
Yeah.
But I think about Bob Dylan a lot. I try to separate my own love of his, you know, music with what he means culturally, and he is also a culturally really important figure, and a figure in Americana, and his understanding of American music is sort of this sort of encyclopedia, and he's a major appropriator. So I like drawing
him
because he steals all over the place. And, you know, so there's a few people that I draw because they represent an idea.
In the dime stores and bus stations, people talk of situations, read books, repeat quotations, draw conclusions on the wall. Some speak of the future. My love, she speaks softly. She knows there's no success like failure, and that failure's no success at all.
In 1965, fresh off the success of Dr. Strangelove, director Stanley Kubrick approached the nearly 70-year-old Dutch artist M.C. Escher about helping him create what Kubrick called a fourth-dimensional film. He wanted to do something never done before cinematically, to push the boundaries of what film could be. Escher had no idea who Kubrick was and politely declined. 3 years later, Kubrick released 2001: A Space Odyssey. Escher died in 1972. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.